Text 51551. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, goodnight stories for rebel girls. More than 100 tales of extraordinary women have a new edition. And in that new edition is a page dedicated to our Sinead Burke. Hello, Sinead.
Hi, good afternoon.
Do you mind being called our Sinead Burke?
What a treat. I feel very warm and welcome. Thank you.
Yeah. And it's 8 years since that TED Talk.
Yeah, which feels like a while ago now, almost 10.
Do you ever watch it back?
I've watched it back a couple of times, and I think what often comes to mind in that moment is remembering how nervous I was and how I was just rattling with nerves, and thinking about on reflection of the TED Talk. So it's all about why design should include everyone. And it's rooted in my lived experience as a person with dwarfism, understanding that my disability is created by just the lack of accessibility in the world and how the world is not designed for me. And I think reflecting on that TED Talk, what I was able to do within that 10 minutes was identify all of the challenges. And I think in the past 7 years, what I've been working on is figuring out the solutions. And I didn't have them 7 years ago.
You did it brilliantly and didn't appear to be nervous at all.
I was in the accessible bathroom of TED's headquarters in New York 30 minutes before I did that, coaching myself in the mirror, telling myself two things. One, no one can tell this story better than you can because it's your story. And two, you're nervous because everybody that you've talked to has said TED will change your life. You have no control over whether or not TED will change your life. So just enjoy it. You may never get an opportunity like this again. And I took a deep breath. And I just enjoyed myself.
That was a great chat with yourself.
Yeah, I do that a lot. Do you know what I mean? It's pretty useful.
Well, this is important, isn't it?
Yeah. But I think we get into our own heads and, you know, often the things that we say to ourselves, strangers wouldn't say to ourselves. So I think trying to stop that inner narrative and monologue so that we don't stop ourselves from doing things that could be great or interesting or good is important.
Because the negative voice, unfortunately, is usually the loudest.
Absolutely. And I think it's built in all of us. And I think if you are a young person, an older person, how you live, what your identities are, what communities you come from, sometimes that voice can be louder because other people amplify it and echo it to you. But I think having that conversation with yourself, tuning down that voice is really important because, yeah.
Do you have a name for your negative voice?
I don't. Do you have one?
No, my wife does.
All right. She for hers or yours?
No, for hers. No, we know each other very well, but she can't get inside my head.
Okay, not yet.
Although, you know, she probably knows me better than I know myself. But no, yeah. So, good night stories for rebel girls. This is huge, isn't it, that you're in this? Yeah.
I think about, you know, I have nephews and nieces who are very young at the moment and who are growing up with an aunt who has a disability, with a grandfather who has a disability. And I think about what stories like this mean for just them, you know, in terms of normalizing what is their normality, because it is normal to them and it is normal. And I think about how a story like this and a book like this would have impacted me growing up. And I think about how for so many children and so many parents and so many families, we just don't want to feel alone. And stories and books do that for us. So I feel very honoured to be part of it.
There's a bit of if you can't see it, you can't be it.
Mm-hmm.
And you're all visibility is hugely important, isn't it?
I think visibility is really important. Representation is important. But what I would say also is that we have to make sure that that's not the only definition of success, because I think, like that, I feel very fortunate to be in this book, and I am sandwiched between, I think, Simone Biles and Taylor Swift, which is the most hilarious sandwich of all time. But the reality is,
there's a claim to fame.
There's, right? but the reality is that the next iteration of this book has to have many more disabled people. It has to be more accessible. It has to have more disabled people who are disabled people of colour, who are trans disabled people, who are disabled travellers, who are disabled people from working class backgrounds. And I think it's about making sure that the systems change too, because we can have visibility and representation, but it doesn't mean that it's any easier to live in the world as a disabled person. And we need that too.
You've been lucky in loads of ways. I suppose been born into the family you were born into was probably just winning the lottery, really.
Yeah, I was born to two amazing parents who were, I don't know if they were advocates by design, but they became advocates in terms of their own relationship.
That's interesting, though. Does anybody, most advocates are sort of forced into it, nudged into it?
Advocates by circumstance, yes, I think. And yeah, it's skills that you have to learn. And I think we all care about different things in the world. And my parents became such strong advocates for me. You know, my dad is a little person also. He has dwarfism, but he grew up in the UK. So when he came to Ireland, married my mom and had children, he was unaware of the education system, of the healthcare system. So they were both finding answers for the first time and trying to make sure that I could be set up for success. And this was an era without the internet. This was an era without proximity to community in the way that we have now. So they were trying to find those answers alone. And I'm so grateful to them, because I think, you know, I went to mainstream school and I think about the advocacy that they did in school and beyond to ensure that I could do the things that I wanted to do. And they believed in me, most importantly.
Where did your parents meet?
They met here in Dublin, and they were both here working, and they met by accident. And I don't think they were supposed to fall in love. I don't think they were supposed to. I don't know if it was in the cards, but they had this mutual connection of love, respect, dignity, pride, and yeah, are together many, many years later with five children and five grandchildren now.
You're the eldest.
I'm the eldest, yes.
And so you grew up, I suppose, with the language. You've said this loads of times, and that's why you're so eloquent and so fluent when it comes to talking as an advocate.
Yes and no. Yes and no. I think I was always given language by my parents as a way in which to facilitate conversations. So to give an example, you know, from the age of four of starting school, children and other parents knew that I was different to them. And my parents always felt it was important for me to have a conversation rather than to ignore it. Of course, you could still be upset by it, but they gave me that language. But I think about even in the work that I do now, you know, to be disabled and to have that lived experience is a skill and creates a level of expertise and a level of intellectual property. I feel like I am articulate and fluent because I have been practicing things like this since the moment I could speak, in the sense that a lot of my independence to date has been reliant on the kindness of strangers. So I spend a lot of my time asking for help, which means from the age of four, I got really used to saying to strangers in a supermarket or wherever, "Hi, my name is Sinead. Would you be able to please pass this to me on the shelf?" And that has built a confidence, but also a fluency.
So you've had to communicate with adults from a very young age, adults that were strangers.
Adults that were strangers. And just, I mean, to give my parents credit, it was always in there, you know, safeguarding, and they were always around. They weren't shipping me off into random spaces. But yeah, and that became a really good skill. And I think also for me, I relied on language from a very young age to demonstrate and prove to people that I wasn't a child.
See, that's important, isn't it?
And I feel like I should never have had to do that. I feel like that wasn't my responsibility as a teenager, but it was a skill built out of a need from society, who would often look at me, think less of my ambition, capacity, skills. And I felt that conversation, language, being well-read, educated, informed, was something that I had to do order to prove myself as valid.
You recognise that look, I'd say.
That, oh, I have it down,
that, that condescending look that people give you.
And
they look into your face as if you're a child.
I think it's sometimes as a child. I think it's sometimes just the deep ableism that's in society, which is the discrimination and the feeling that disabled people are less than or less valid or less skilled. And I think lots of disabled people, lots of marginalised people are used to that. And I have great grace. I have great understanding. I fundamentally believe that we don't know what we don't know. I see part of my role as being an educator. It is not disabled people's role to educate people. They get to be who they are and get to stand proud and be proud in society without having to play that role. But yeah, I think, and I've moved into a space now where I'm a business owner and a business person. And I think as part of that, I find myself in rooms and in conversations where people underestimate me and where people underestimate the business. And I think that genuine curiosity is really useful. I find the challenge really constructive, but it's a lot to come up against.
Okay, we'll talk about tilting the lens in a moment, but just before we leave language.
Yes.
As a heading.
Sure.
Sometimes people are, I suppose, cautious about talking about disability in case they use the wrong words and offend.
Sure.
Yeah.
So I'd love to challenge that, because I think lots of people lead with good intentions. And I think disability, like many other topics to do with identity, to your point, people have a sensitivity. And I think people who are well-intentioned, well-meaning, often say, I don't know what to say because I'm worried I'll say the wrong thing, which results in two things. One, they say nothing at all, which creates deeper exclusion. And two, what they are actually doing there, I think, in a way, even though it's not necessarily the cause, but it is the effect, is they are prioritizing themselves. Because I think in society,
yes, very good.
I think in society, we are deeply afraid of being embarrassed. So you might say the wrong thing. And yes, you may risk offending somebody. But sometimes what we're afraid of is being wrong. And I think we should relinquish that fear, encourage it. And I think most people will respond that if you say the wrong thing, I have a whole framework where if you say the wrong thing to me once, the first time I'll echo back to you the right word. Okay. I won't comment on it. I'll just give you the right word so that you hear it. I ignore that you said the wrong word. The second time I'll say to you, actually, it's this is the preferential term. And then the third time, if we get to a third time, I will name it and say, actually, what you've said multiple times is incorrect and is offensive. Now, I do that. That is not anybody else's job. So I think we should move ourselves away from this fear of, I don't want to say the wrong thing, and to say, you know what, I'm willing to try.
Yeah.
And if I make a mistake, I'm going to learn from it. And then I probably won't do it again. But what is worse, to try to be embarrassed and to include people, or to say, you know what, it's most important that I don't get it wrong, that I don't offend, so I'm just not going to try. And we look at where disability is in society here in Ireland and around the world, and we just don't have time for people to not try.
And it's not about you. It's no. In effect, what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Try.
Yeah. Do your best. Do your best. And learn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Make an effort. Make an effort. So tilting the lens.
Yes.
So you've it's sort of nearly like making a business out of advocacy.
I think you could absolutely frame it like that. The reality is when I set up the business 4 years ago, the reason and the rationale was because I had been fortunate to do advocacy in a lot of different rooms and spaces. And then the pandemic happened. If we look just at the data, the pandemic was positive in some ways because we had the most amount of disabled people ever employed in the world because of the reliability of Zoom and Google Meets and Microsoft Teams that allows accessibility built in. But simultaneously, if we look to England, in the first wave of the pandemic, 6 out of 10 people who died of COVID-19 were disabled. If we look at even the language that we used around the pandemic, when people died, we talked about them as vulnerable or having underlying conditions. We took respiration equipment off disabled people, particularly even in the UK, and gave it to non-disabled people in hospitals because they were deemed to be more valid and more viable for life. And we haven't globally, I think, had conversations about that. And we talk about the pandemic being over, and for lots of people with chronic illnesses and with underlying conditions, they still are very unsafe in certain spaces. And all of this really made me question myself and my advocacy. And it made me ask if things had become more accessible for me or if they had become more accessible for everyone. And I think some of the reality is it became more accessible for me. And my fundamental belief is that's not good enough. And what it also made me recognise is we can create visibility and representation and create exceptions. But in order for things to be better for everyone, we have to change systems. Mm. We have to change policy. We have to change pathways and opportunities to employment. We have to change things today, tomorrow, forever. And they have to be done in a way that benefits as many people as possible, particularly those from multiply marginalised communities. And the reality is I can't do that alone. So setting up a business was really fundamental for two reasons. One, the non-profit and the charitable sector does excellent work here. But as a society, we often deem disability equals charity, which creates a mindset that it is something that is just good to do rather than something that can be valuable to the economy or something that is valuable in terms of a skill set of a whole cohort of people. So I set up the company 4.5 years ago. I went and did a business course in Judge Business School in Cambridge because my background is not in business, and tried to understand how I could build an organisation and a team. And we're currently a team of 6 based across Europe, the majority of whom are disabled, but not all. And we work across different pillars from built environment to digital accessibility to product and service design and research with disabled people to really try to understand from fashion to banking to education to government, how can we create meaningful ways for disabled people to
access. So you become a disabled voice in the room.
we become a vehicle for disabled voices to be in the room. So to give you an example, thinking about research that we did most recently in the banking sector, we did it with a whole cohort of Irish people, Irish disabled people here. And what we've been able to do is through a co-design model is really take the suggestions, innovations and ideas that disabled people have about why banking is so inaccessible to them, bring them to the banking sector and put the solutions in place.
All right. So you, as a little person.
Yes.
Banking.
Yes.
What are the challenges there?
I think banking...
An ATM. Can you reach an ATM?
I can't reach an ATM, right. At least most ATMs. Right. And I think when we look at the design of those things, you know, they're particularly designed for a standard height. There is some fluctuation in them. For some particularly internal ATMs, maybe some wheelchair users can use them. And what I've done as part of my just experience in terms of getting older and having to use banking is adapt to different kinds of systems. It has meant that I've moved away from a cash-based society much faster than most people.
I suppose most people did with COVID, didn't they? Yeah.
And I think it's about, you know, for me in terms of banking, some of the work is about thinking from its broadest aspect. So whether we think about mobile and app banking, whether we think about kind of customer service and being able to get support there, or whether it's through, you know, chat-based technology. And I think in some ways I have day-to-day challenges with banking, but due to the increase in technology, my access needs have been solved. But while my access needs have been solved because I can do banking online for people with intellectual disabilities, for people who are blind and low vision, for people who are deaf, that has become increasingly challenging due to the lack of people in retail banking and branches. So I think what we realise is that accessibility is not just one solution. It has to be multiple solutions for different types of people. But again, if you're an older person, if you're a person who doesn't speak English as a first language, if you have literacy difficulties, you fall into that category too, and accessibility would benefit you.
Of course, the disability community is not homogeneous. So
not at all.
And it's so diverse.
Absolutely. And becoming more and more diverse as we think about the number of people who are for the first time understanding and getting a diagnosis or self-diagnosing with neurodivergence, the number of people who are talking about being dyslexic, the number of people who are understanding chronic illness, or just even that idea that disability can also be temporary. You know, when we think about apparent and non-apparent disabilities, if you break your leg, you have a temporary experience of disability. If you have cancer, you have a temporary experience of disability. So I think some of our understanding of disability also
has to evolve.
Not to
be glib, would you run for the presidency?
I'm too young. You have to be 35.
What?
I know.
But you're 35 this year, no?
Ray, don't be redirecting the conversation. I'm too young today.
I've read copious amounts of interviews that you've done. I believe when it comes time for the presidential election, you, Sinead Burke, will be of age. Is that correct? I put it
of
to you
this
now.
Year.
Yeah.
Is it factually correct that I will be 35 at the time of this year's presidential? Yes.
Yes. Great. So I'll ask you again then. Would you ever think of running for the presidency?
There is so much work to do. My goal for the next 10 years is to build Tilting the Lens into a model and a business that can exist independently of me.
But just you know, stay with me.
Sure. Yeah. I'm on the journey. Go ahead.
But we spoke earlier on about visibility.
Yeah.
And that's a huge part of it. Imagine the visibility of Sinead Burke being the President of Ireland.
Ray, I was born in 1990. You know,
yes. Mary Robinson.
Grew up in the era of Mary Robinson. Yeah. She became president the year I was born. Her speech, where she talked about the women of Ireland didn't just rock the cradle, they rocked the system, was fundamental. And then we had Mary McAleese, and so much of the work that she did around the north of Ireland was fundamental. And then I've been fortunate through President Hingen's second term to be on the Council of State, and I've learned so much. So it's an incredibly important role. I'm really looking forward
You've
to
been
voting
in the house.
And seeing.
You've been in the house a few times.
Yeah, it's quite nice.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's not something that I am thinking about or considering as of right now. And to be honest, it's not about whether or not it's something I want. It's about whether or not something I could add value to and be of service. It is about if I have the right skills to be able to support a role. It's a role for the country. It's not a role for any individual.
Sounds like you've given it a bit of thought.
Still 34, right? Still 34.
Yeah, no, 35 by the end of the year. 35 by the end of the year. So little people, I was watching the BAFTAs. Were you watching the BAFTAs?
I was.
And you see Warwick Davis.
He got a fellowship. It's very exciting. I'm so pleased for him.
Does your dad know him? Would they have been in contact with each other?
See, no. This is where I throw the question back to you and say, not all little people know each other, no. But I do know Warwick.
No, but yeah. I'll tell you why I asked that question. Because he was fundamental in setting up Little People...
UK,
yes. And your dad set up Little People Ireland.
Yes.
That's why I asked.
So Warwick and his wife, Sammy, and Sammy unfortunately passed within the past year. She passed away. Ah. Set up Little People UK. And yes, my parents in 1997 set up Little People of Ireland. I was really pleased for Warwick, again, when we think about representation and visibility, to see him have that moment on stage in front of the entire British and TV and film industry was really important. And I think, you know, sometimes it's about finding those moments to celebrate people. And I think about everybody who was watching that show, who, you know, his children in the front row, Annabelle and Harrison, and how proud they must have
been. And they're little people too.
Yeah.
And they spoke so lovingly and glowingly about him. It was lovely. It was a lovely thing.
It was really great.
It was a lovely thing, yeah. You tell that story, and I love it. And a lot of people have told the story as well about, you know, finding their tribe in the George.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, that you were going out, you were in Trinity College.
Yeah.
And did you find it dangerous out in other clubs, or was it threatening, or what was the vibe for you?
Yeah, I think maybe to give context. So I was in college, and, you know, part of college is, you know, an element of nightlife. And being also a little person, being a woman, often nightlife and spaces didn't feel very safe, didn't feel very comfortable, both from the accessibility of those spaces, but then also just other people's behaviour in those spaces and how I just often felt really uncomfortable. And it made me want to opt out. It made me want to not be social and sociable, and I felt like at 18 that wasn't unfair. That was unfair, that everybody has the right, I think, to access nightlife and those community spaces. And I found the George and had been fortunate to know Veda and Shirley Temple Bar and Panty and a whole cohort of drag queens who just made me feel so explicitly welcome. And it was a space where everybody was different, and difference wasn't a bad thing, but it was celebrated and welcomed. And I felt safe, and I felt like I had the opportunity to dance without observation. Mm. And I just had the space to have a good time.
And it seems trivial enough, but in reading all the interviews mm-hmm. you've done and watching you, it seems to have been pivotal, though. That was it?
I think the idea of feeling safe
yeah.
is not something we should ever underestimate. And I think we are living in a world and in a time where lots of people's safety is becoming less. I think about how, you know, through the increase of TikTok or Instagram algorithms, how often people are, you know, observed in public and don't feel safe, and whether that's walking home late at night or whether that's in a nightclub. So the idea that you feel safe to let down your shoulders, to take a deep breath, to feel like you have the space to just be and enjoy with friends is really hard to measure, but it has a fundamental impact on who we are as people.
We've only scratched the surface. We've run out of time. So hopefully it won't be as long the next time, as in I never spoke to you before, so that's a very long time. So Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls, more than 100 tales of extraordinary women, and one of those extraordinary women is Sinead Burke. Sinead, thank you so much.
Ray, thank you.
Thank you.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.